Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everyone. Unlike the last 2 weeks where we have botched it by taping too early in the week, this week, I think, coming on the heels of Paul Ryan and the Republican debate, which I think we're going to talk about today, I think we finally got our timing right, Bill Scherr.
A broken clock is right twice a year or something like that. I think Rick Perry said that.
We had a real problem of taping. We would tape these shows, and like within an hour of taping it, and we're spending an hour and a half talking about stuff, or at least an hour. Then some news would break that would render our entire conversation pretty much irrelevant. And I think now, Lord willing, we have solved that problem by taping the morning after the debate.
Now, you've had, I think, a busy 12 hours because I think perhaps more than anyone, you are shaping the pundit class's conventional wisdom, because you are out there not only saying that Rubio had the grand slam at the debate last night, but that you just put up a piece that Jeb Bush should throw in the towel now, which one of our great DMZ fans, Robin DePell, said, "Hey, Matt, you're only doing this to screw Bill Scherr because Bill's on record saying Jeb's going to get it." And I have to agree. This is clearly you've been subtweeting me all night long, and I'm not going to be like Jeb Bush. I'm not going to sit here and take it, Matt. I'm going to bring it today.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to, you know, this is the DMZ. This isn't the
DMZ rules are off, okay? This is not the DMZ anymore. This is no holds barred. Team Jeb versus Team Rubio. This is the debate you didn't get last night. Now you're going to get it.
Well, it was a messy, ugly debate. And we should probably get into CNBC and the backlash against them, but... But I will take your praise, Bill, and say I think that this goes to my book, Too Dumb to Fail. And basically part of my premise is that this is a we're at a crossroads. OK, and the Republican Party and the conservative movement can go in the direction of Donald Trump and Ben Carson, or it can go in the direction of Paul Ryan and Marco Rubio. And one of those directions, I think, is an angry populist world of limited resources, they're out to get us world. And the other is a solutions, optimistic, conservative vision. And my book, and I am encouraging we go toward that solutions-oriented Rubio-Ryan direction. And I think the last 24 hours really show that as pessimistic as it's easy to be about the future of conservatism, I think Rubio clearly won the debate. And I think Paul Ryan's going to be the Speaker of the House later on today as we're taping this. So there's cause for optimism. But the danger, I think, is that Jeb Bush flailing on his way out the door rather than spending his resources to go after Donald Trump and be a force for good seems to have dedicated himself to trying to take down Marco Rubio. Now, it backfired. Rubio slapped him down viciously in that debate. But let's take Mike Murphy, who runs Jeb Bush's super PAC, who's known for going negative. It's scary to think what might happen if he unleashes those tens of millions of dollars on trying to take down Marco Rubio. That would be a rather ironic legacy for Jeb Bush to have if he helps elect Donald Trump.
Well, I think there's no risk of electing Donald Trump. I think that I think there's no risk of nominating Donald Trump. This actually was discussed on Morning Joe today because Mark Halperin is agreeing with me, which I grant you doesn't necessarily bode well for my prediction. but Halperin was saying that let's stipulate Rubio won the debate. Rubio's going to get his turn in the spotlight now. I mean, I can't quite predict what the poll spike is going to be if this actually gives him a substantive boost and puts him on par with where Trump and Carson are now. But certainly he's going to get a huge spike in media attention. And I think what comes of that media vetting, which we'll see. We'll see how he handles it. I would completely agree that if he gets his turn in the spotlight – and he gets the full vet and he clears it, then the establishment would abandon Jeb and go to Rubio. You know, my Jeb prediction was premised on the notion that he would retain a modicum of establishment support no matter what. Not that he was an amazing candidate, but that he could outlast everybody else once they all get their 15 minutes and they fail to vet. And no one would be able to consolidate the anti-establishment forces and best Jeb mano a mano. But if the establishment leaves Jeb altogether and goes to Rubio, that undercuts my specific prediction. It would undercut my underlying point about the dynamics within the Republican Party, just a question of which face gets to be the established right, well, face.
My take is I think there's a serious challenge ahead, and I think Donald Trump has been ahead in most polls for 100 days, and then Ben Carson's the next guy, and there's a real danger. I mean, look, we're not 6 months out anymore. We're getting, you know,
well,
it's,
you
now
know,
is
we
the
are,
time.
We are three,
and I think
we
need to coalesce around
somebody. A lot could happen in 3 months.
No, things change late. I mean, yeah, you've been you make the Jeb Bush John Kerry comparison, and that's a great example that proves your point. I mean, John Kerry fired his campaign manager in December and looked down, and I think it was December, it might have been November, but it was late in the game. He looked down and out, and obviously he was able to bring it together late. But I'm telling you, maybe Jeb Bush can salvage this. Maybe he can make a comeback, but there's literally been no signs of hope at all. There's been nothing that would lead you to believe that Jeb, other than the fact that he has a lot of money, which is a big other than, but there's been nothing that would lead anyone to believe that Jeb Bush has what it takes to be the man of the moment in the Republican Party right now.
I want to draw, because you mentioned my John Kerry parallel, which Matt seen me make on Twitter. I haven't had a chance to put that to paper yet. But just to go back to what I was saying about Halpern, Halpern was saying, look, if Rubio doesn't actually rise, then Jeb would be able to say, I'm still your best choice for an electable, plausible establishment candidate. And Joe Scarborough was saying, no. If Rubio fails to rise, and if Christie fails to rise, and Kasich fails to rise, you know, Jeb's ridden himself out of the picture already, then you're going to be stuck with Trump or Carson. So, you know, so Joe's more where you are, and I'm more where Halpern is as far as that respect is concerned. But I really feel
like Jeb, I mean, I've said this a million times, so I don't want to like bore people, but I really feel like Jeb, as they said of Winston Churchill, is a man with a brilliant future behind him. Now, Churchill was able to surprise everyone and forge a comeback. I don't think Jeb can get the souffle to rise twice. Jeb was a perfectly suited Republican. He was a great conservative governor of Florida. And if it was 1998, I would think he'd be a perfect candidate for the moment of the Republican Party. But the window has closed. And we've seen with whether it's Barack Obama running in 2008 or Chris Christie not running in 2012, these moments do not last forever. You have a window of time, and I think that time has passed Jeb Bush by. It seems like the moment, at least right now, is for someone like Marco Rubio, but not if Jeb Bush helps destroy him.
Well, let me go deeper into the John Kerry parallel here, because I think there are a lot. I think that the backdrops are similar. You know, in 2003, you had a Democratic Party electorate that was disgusted with the Democratic Party establishment over the Iraq War. All the leading candidates had voted for the war resolution, so that it had tarred Kerry, it had tarred Gephardt, it had tarred John Edwards. And then you had, you know, two outsiders, Howard Dean and Wesley Clark, that were soaking up all the oxygen. You know, Dean had the good run in the summer. Wesley Clark shows up in September. He gets an initial spike in the polls. So the polls in September and October, it's Dean and Clark tussling with each other. And Kerry is beginning to be written off for dead at that point. And in part because he was not making his mark in the debates. Now, he didn't have as big a specific embarrassment as Jeb had last night, but he was just not making a dent in what was going on. And he never did. I mean, he never won a debate the whole time. He just hung around, you know, spent his money on good organizing on the ground and waited until, you know, I mean, Clark tanked quicker. He had sort of a month and then he faded. And then Dean came back up again. And then, you know, all the bricks came down on Dean in mid-December, going into January, to the point where he performed way below expectations in Iowa. So it's possible to not win debates.
Sure.
And I think, and I think that, but just to finish the point, I mean, at the end of the day,
I paid for this microphone.
You know, once you get very close to actual voting, you right now in these debates, the impetus is on who can impress the Republican-based crowd in the room the most. And so you get a lot of beating up on the moderators and, you know, red meat proposals that, you know, have no chance of actually passing. And once you get close to election day, you start to focus in on what's the matchup going to be? Who is actually going to go toe-to-toe with Hillary Clinton in this case? Whereas, you know, in 2003, 2004, it was who's going to go up against George W. Bush? Dean started to crumble when he was dismissive at the capture of Saddam Hussein, saying it was not going to make us safe. A comment that today you wouldn't bat an eye at. At the time, it seemed like, oh my God, he can't go up against George Bush with a message like that. So the fact that Jeb, I think Jeb might never have a good debate. I don't think he does well in that this kind of primary scrum format. But he may look like a plausible matchup to Hillary once you get closer to Election Day, depending on how Rubio does between now and, right, and December, January.
The problem with that, Bill, and I can see that nobody knows what's going to happen, and I've been wrong before, and anything could happen. The problem with your theory, though, is that there is one person in America who is least well-positioned to run against Hillary Clinton, and it's the one guy who cannot talk about the future, who is not fresh-faced, and who is who cannot talk about dynasties. And it's Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush, if your argument is who's best prepared to go up against Hillary when we all get serious and it all comes down to a general election nominee, Jeb Bush can't talk about dynasties. He can't talk about, oh, yesterday, a candidate from yesterday had ideas from yesterday. He is yesterday. It's a dynasty thing. He takes one of the most compelling arguments that Republicans have, a generational change, completely off the table.
Well, I think that's premised on that is the best line against Hillary. I mean, obviously, that is the Rubio argument, a generational argument.
And I would argue that that's probably the most. Look, you and I agree, Bill, that scandals are not the silver bullets that people think they are.
I agree with that.
I think that brand is much more important, and I do believe that parties generally do not go backwards generationally. The Democratic Party, if they are to win with Hillary Clinton, will be doing two things. Number one, winning three consecutive general elections, which is hard for anybody to do. Doesn't happen a lot. Number two, going backward generationally to an older candidate than the guy that they just had. I like Republicans' chances much better with someone who basically is young, energetic, optimistic conservative can talk about the future, not the past.
I mean, that's what Rubio's going to try to do. Now, I think that's now going to be tested, because, you know, the flip side of that is that Rubio's not ready. That he's too green. He's not ready for prime time. He doesn't have much of a record. His one moment of leadership in the Senate was a bust, that being an immigration reform. He gets hit sometimes from interviewers. You say you're the candidate of the future, yet you have outdated opinions about gay rights and climate change. So how are you exactly the candidate of the future here? He's going to have to deal with those sorts
outdated
of things.
Outdated according.
If he clears those bars.
Outdated according to
I'm
some.
Sorry?
Outdated according to some people.
I mean, according to the generations that he's supposedly representing. I mean, that's.
Well, millennials are pro-life and they like Uber. So Hillary's out, right? Because she's tied to
I don't think Hillary's.
She doesn't like the sharing economy.
Well,
she's tied to labor unions.
That's a big jump that Hillary's anti-Uber.
She's tied to central command, top-down sort of, industrial revolution world as opposed to an entrepreneurial free market solutions-based
world.
I'm just saying
Hillary's
going
to be able to talk entrepreneurial
free
market talk? Have you not seen how this person operates? You think she's going to run like a statist socialist?
She's a good politician, and so is Rubio. And I think Rubio could actually argue with her better than Bush.
I think that's going to come down to that because, I mean, Jeb, if you're aware, of course, maybe not everyone has seen, but, you know, Jeb had a big confab with his donors right before this debate, where it was tended to kind of get them assuaged that Jeb was in this for the long haul and had a game plan. And so there was apparently a slideshow that was leaked out where he has a slide saying that Rubio is the GOP Obama, that there's going to need to be a contrast with the current president, and Hillary is going to do experience and competence, and Rubio won't be able to do that. And you had pointed out on your Twitter feed, I think in a Daily Caller post or Daily Beast post, that this is not much of an insult because Obama won twice and got a lot of the policies that he wanted, and Rubio would be positioned to do that. And I think it was strange for I think it was astute at the presentation to recognize that Rubio is the lone threat to Jeb winning this nomination. It's not Trump, Carson, Fiorina, because they're going to collapse on their own weight. Trump is jostling with Rubio is jostling with Jeb for that establishment lane. There is a generational divide between them that Rubio can potentially exploit. And Jeb has to be able to show that the experience card outweighs the Rubio generational card. If Jeb's going to have to be able to show in some way, look, you're going up against a Hillary Clinton, almost certainly, who is no slouch when it comes to debate prep, who is going to have all the facts and figures at the ready. And if you come in with a half-assed game, you're going to get crushed. Now, Jeb.
Okay, but let me just stop you there. Yeah. There's nothing about Jeb that would lead me to believe that all of his experience makes him better prepared to eloquently debate Hillary Clinton than Marco Rubio. Number one. Number two, I think that if Rubio had never been elected to anything, he would be susceptible to these charges. I think he meets the threshold, certainly. He's been a U.S. senator for 5 or 6 years. He was the Speaker of the House of Florida. Now, look, if you're going to go toe-to-toe against Hillary Clinton, who was the first lady, who was a Secretary of State and a U.S. senator, if the election's about experience, nobody can beat her. But guess what? Elections usually aren't about experience. I mean, I would rather, given the choice between generational change and optimism in the future versus experience, if those are the choices, I'll bet on the fresh face. Bill Clinton beat President George H.W. Bush, who had been head of the CIA, who had run the RNC, who had been a congressman, and by the way, an incumbent president, and by the way, oversaw the defeat of the Soviet Union, and by the way, Vice President of the United States with Ronald Reagan for 8 years. And then he beat Bob Dole, who was the Senate Majority Leader and a World War II war hero. Guess why? Bill Clinton was the governor of Arkansas, and he did it because he offered that freshness, that youth, and that energy, and Americans liked it. So all of a sudden, you're telling me now that experience is what matters.
Well, No.
When Hillary's husband ran, it wasn't.
No, I 100% agree. Experience, resume by themselves never determine elections. I believe very strongly. So I'm not making that case. Although I don't think it's true that the youngest person always beats the oldest person. I don't think that is a determinative factor.
Yeah, there's a threshold.
I think that I think Hillary is very good at emanating a degree of steadiness and competence by her performances. They're not charismatic performances. They're not, you know, they don't make you jump off of your chair. But there's a depth to her answers that I think on her best days works for her. On her worst days, they come across
Hillary's
as calculating
tough. You're not going to get an argument from me. Hillary is very tough and very formidable. I will gladly concede that. She will be very tough to beat, and she'll be good in the debates. And I think we also agree, as I mentioned earlier, that it's not, you can't count on scandal or Benghazi taking her down. I mean, if it does, that's icing on the cake, but you can't rely on that happening.
Now, when we talk about the last Hillary debate, I'm bringing it, Marco.
Don't call me Marco. Right now, Rubio is winning the Matt Lewis primary, but I'm not in the tank. He can still blow it. He can still blow it. But look, I'd like to see Cruz versus Rubio in the final round, and that's the time for choosing. You've got two young, but very smart, both conservatives who represent different sort of wings within the movement. I would much rather that if it comes down to that, I think we'll be very happy, and that would be a good way to go rather than the Trump way.
But this is the mean question I'm going to put to you, Matt.
All right.
So 2 weeks ago, when we debated the Democrat debate, Hillary versus Bernie debate, you agree that Hillary won, but you also thought there was an undercurrent of vulnerability because she used a lot of sophistry and misdirection. When you look at the Jeb Marco exchange, or also the Marco exchange involving his personal finances, he got asked in the debate. You know, his response to Jeb was not a defense of his Senate record. It was, you are a poor messenger to make this case against me because you didn't do this for John McCain. And when he was asked about his personal finance, it was, you know, you moderator are just recycling these decredited charges from the Democrats. In neither case did he actually defend the specifics of the charges. I mean, and then I said 2 weeks ago, look, all politicians misdirect when they have kind of favorable questions. So that I don't find this to be shocking in any way or disqualifying. But would he get off so easily?
Not only is it not disqualifying, but it's a prerequisite to winning. It's a prerequisite to winning the election.
But would Hillary? I mean, there were follow-ups that Jeb could have done there that he did not do. I find it strange that Jeb engaged it at all at this juncture. I mean, it's one thing if Rubio was actually the front runner and he had to take him down. Rubio hadn't really come out of the second tier yet, and so it seemed kind of premature to jump all over him, and especially if you weren't ready for the comeback. I mean, obviously Rubio's going to be prepared for this, and Jeb didn't have a counter rebut.
Jeb is temperamentally an introvert. He doesn't like. I don't even think it's that he thinks he's above it. I just don't think he's cut out for this. The scrum, as you said, it's not his milieu, and yet he has to do it. His body language betrays that he's not comfortable doing it. It was awkward. It wasn't going to work.
Rubio implied somebody was pushing him to do it. First punch quite comfortably. I've heard this a lot that he was sort of going through the motions. I thought he leveled that French work week line pretty well. And the crowd, I thought he got a decent chuckle out of that. He just didn't come back once Rubio had the rejoinder. Jeb didn't seem to know what to say in response to that. That's what struck me. I thought the initial attack was, you know, was joyfully waged.
Right, but this is always, look, this is like in the big leagues, everybody can hit 100-mile-per-hour fastball. But you have to be able to hit a curveball. And I think this is the big leagues. Everybody's going to be able to come back from the first attack if they're in the big leagues. But how do you handle that rejoinder? And Jeb was, I just think it's not his strength. What was I going to say? What was the larger question?
Do you think that Rubio is actually, I mean, look, he's had three solid debates. I'm not discounting that at all.
Oh, but yeah.
I don't think he has gone up against what a Hillary would do to him in a debate yet. When you see him on the stage, do you think, you know what, I'm quite sure he can handle that because he's shown how, you know, he didn't flinch at these attacks? Or do you say, you know what, this is still kind of minor league ball dependent relative to where he's going to end up being?
That's a very good question. Number one, we never know how people, it's like drafting a quarterback from college. You never really know how they're going to perform in the NFL when the spotlight's on. But I would say, number one, I think Hillary did engage in all sorts of misdirection and sophistry during that inquiry. And guess what? She's pretty good at it. And guess what? It works. And it's going to work in debates. It's going to help her. And I think all modern politicians have to have the ability to parry questions. And I think Rubio showed last night he is incredibly adept at doing so, at spinning without looking like he's spinning, at sticking to his strengths. I think he did a masterful job last night. And you would have the CNBC moderators ask him, why are you still beating your wife questions? And he would manage to turn it around and not even appear to be defensive at all. So I think this is actually batting practice for Rubio. I really do. I think that these debates, in many ways, they're negatives for Republicans. In many ways, this series of debates probably hurt Republicans. I think if Rubio ends up being the nominee, the fact that he's gone through these series of debates will have actually helped prepare him to take on Hillary. Make no mistake, Hillary's really tough. She's really good, and it's going to be a challenge. I just happen to think that of all the candidates on the stage, there's a handful of them who could go toe-to-toe with her. I think Rubio has the dexterity, eloquence, and intellectual capacity to do it. I think Chris Christie, because of his toughness, could do it. But I don't think we're in danger of that happening anytime soon. But I think Jeb Bush is actually one of the worst candidates that Republicans could nominate. I think that the establishment would like it. The establishment would love Clinton versus Bush because Clinton would win. I don't think Bush has what it takes. I don't think, you know, there's that book, What It Takes. I don't think he has what it takes. Now, maybe he proves me wrong. I just don't think he has it.
Now, you said at the top of the show that this is a great day for solutions-oriented conservatives because Rubio's on the way up and Ryan's taking over the speakership. Has the vote happened yet, by the way? Did he get the 218? Do you know?
I don't know. I'm monitoring Twitter a little bit, and I'm seeing that, you know, Boehner just gave a speech, and Sean Duffy's children are there to witness, or son's there to witness history. Apparently Mitt Romney is in the gallery in the front row. I do not know if I've not seen the vote officially declare him speaker, so I'm going to say that it has not happened yet.
Well, but my question to you is,
the Dems have nominated Nancy Pelosi for speaker, apparently.
So. I mean, I certainly agree that Paul Ryan is a solutions-oriented guy. He has produced actual budgets before that have been greatly debated. There's things he wants to accomplish. I agree with that. Marco Rubio, actually, I know, has a whole suite of policy papers that he's put out. So I know he's not totally out of his depth in that regard. But in neither case are Rubio and Ryan having good days because of those policy positions. There was no real policy debate at the debate last night. It was like who can beat up on the media the most. Rubio has not really had his policy positions vetted, had to defend them under attack. Ryan has yet to. I mean, it's one thing to get a budget pass with party unity when there's no chance of it actually getting to the president's desk. Now he's in the position of trying to get things passed that might actually become policies. This is when the caucus seems to break apart. And he couldn't even get 218 out of his caucus for the nomination. He still lost the Freedom Caucus. He lost 43 votes. So there still is this warning shot that we're not on your team yet, buddy. We might let you get this far, but...
Well, I don't know. I don't know if that's 100% right, Bill. I mean, the Freedom Caucus had, before Ryan even got in, had committed to endorsing Daniel Webster. And I think some of the votes that went to Daniel Webster were simply out of loyalty to him and out of respect for the fact that they had endorsed him. Some of them were probably protest votes against Ryan, but I think some of them were just, look, this is the primary. We're going to vote for our guy that we told we were going to support to not embarrass him. But tomorrow, when it's on the real floor, it's the general election, Ryan's our nominee. We're good Republicans. We're going to support our nominee. So that's how Trent Franks described it on CNN yesterday. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think that I wouldn't read it as a negative against Ryan that so many Republicans voted for Webster.
But the underlying fault lines that end up dooming Boehner have not been resolved by Ryan's ascension. The next thing that conservatives demand that are implausible to achieve, and Ryan doesn't follow suit, he's going to end up in the same pickle.
Okay, so a couple things. Number one, John Boehner, quote unquote, cleaned the barn. So Ryan's not going to have to worry about wrangling votes for debt ceilings or CRs and anytime
in the near future. I agree.
That buys him time. Ryan also has the potential to focus on big picture ideas, tax reform, entitlement reform, and to restore regular order where he's giving people more notice when votes are going to come up. Dropping things on them.
Let's say he pushes tax reform now. He became Ways and Means chair so he could do tax reform. He really wants to have a tax reform deal that Obama actually signs, not just something to propose and have go away. He says that we need to be a proposition party, not an opposition party. Any tax reform bill he puts on the table will not get universal praise from Republicans. It is impossible to do that. It would require bipartisan compromise, and conservatives who want it to be a net tax cut, for example, aren't going to get that. Anything they're going to get is going to be revenue neutral. It just seems like once he crosses that threshold into actual legislating, I mean, I agree, he could do nothing for the year and stay in his job because Boehner's done it, taking all the bullets. But he claims to want to do something, and doing the something is where he's going to get into trouble.
Well, look, okay, number one, obviously there are challenges in the Republican Party. That's why I'm writing my book, and in the conservative movement. Leadership, I think it was Harry Truman who said leadership is about convincing people to do the things they should have had the good sense to do in the first place. That's what leaders do. If anybody can do it, Paul Ryan can do it. Now, maybe it can't be done, but I think now at least there's cause for hope and optimism that we finally have a guy who is liked enough, respected enough, and eloquent enough to persuade his members, enough of them, to pass a conservative agenda. And I think the fact that he's not going to be tripped up by debt ceilings helps him get off to a good start. Now, there's always a chance it'll fall apart, but sometimes leaders make a difference. Sometimes leaders actually inspire people and persuade people to get behind them. The notion that that's impossible scares me. I think, you can have countries, you can have companies that you can have football teams that are in disarray. And then you get someone who steps up and gets people to start believing in the system, believing in the team, believing in the country. Ryan has an opportunity. If anybody can do it, I think it's him. Maybe he can, maybe he can't, but I think there's a chance that he can. And it's a time, let's let him have a honeymoon before we start declaring him a failure.
Well, give the guy a shot. But I think I don't see how if he tries to lead, as John Boehner would say, if you're leading, no one's following you, you're just a guy going for a walk.
Right.
If he's putting forward this tax reform plan, the Freedom Caucus makes unreasonable demands, it's going to be a pretty quick bust. And we've already seen an example of leadership in the Congress hurt somebody, and that is Marco Rubio. I mean, Marco Rubio, and I think it's probably one of the biggest Achilles heels that has yet to really been played on him. You tried to be a leader one time in the Senate, and you completely screwed it up. You voted for a bill, then you ran away from it. That is the exact opposite of leadership.
Well, look, I mean, I agree. Immigration reform is a rough issue for Rubio, but he at least tried to be a leader, unlike Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, who never championed any sort of landmark legislation in the Senate. In fact, Barack Obama sort of stepped on immigration reform for the labor union, sort of behind the scenes, according to John McCain, at least, and others. So, sometimes you try to actually do something and it back. I think Rubio would have been smarter to just talk about immigration reform, but never actually be a leader, never actually try to get anything done. That's what Obama did, and I think it worked better for him politically.
Well, if you're gonna stick your neck out, you got to go all the way, and he flinched.
Well, he passed it in the Senate. He's a U.S. senator. He championed it for 6 months, passed it in the Senate,
and then he talked it down in the House. I mean, he didn't follow through and champion his own bill to get through the House.
Well, I think there was a realization that bill, it was dead on arrival. It's not going to pass. And so, it's a fool's errand to try to pass something. And by the way, Paul Ryan, I think it's important to note, Paul Ryan has pledged that as long as Barack Obama is in the White House, he's not going to push immigration reform. I think that's key. I think that Ryan, clearly, what he needs to do is push for conservative reforms in legislation that the Tea Party and that the Freedom Caucus can support, and steer clear of the hot-button controversial issues like immigration reform. As much as I believe in it, it's just not going to happen while Barack Obama is in the White House.
But now what happens, say, and I don't know what Ryan's timing is, what if he proposes some big tax reform plan by January, December or January? I mean, I assume he's not going to twiddle his thumbs, for months on end. We want to be a proposition party, you better start now, right? What if he puts something down there and the hard right doesn't like it? What does Rubio do? What does Jeb do? And what does Cruz do?
Right. Well, look, they're already, Rubio's already going against the budget deal that cleaned the barn for Paul Ryan, that Paul Ryan voted for. So Ryan and Rubio frequently have found themselves, even though I think they're very similar stylistically, and I think that they're in the same mold of my brand of conservatism, they've quite often found themselves on differing ends. And I think Rand Paul's going to lead a filibuster to try to block the cleaning of the barn.
He's going to talk for a couple hours and lose a filibuster vote, more likely.
But I think Rubio will on the record be against the cleaning of the barn, or the clearing of the barn, or whatever it was called, which is the smart political move, of course.
Anything else about the debate that it captures your fancy?
Yeah, almost out of time, Bill, but I do want to ask you about the CNBC moderators.
Yes.
They were booed a few times by the audience, and clearly not only have conservatives turned against them on Twitter, and they're being mocked on Twitter pretty viciously, but I think it was a consensus opinion that CNBC had a really horrible night all the way around. I see a lot of mainstream journalists mocking them. What was your take on how CNBC handled the debate?
I mean, a CNBC debate, more than any other debate, should be a deep policy debate. I think they took some stabs at that. But they had too many kinds of questions that were just, well, one, any kind of question like, what's your biggest weakness, is just a terrible question. You know, that's a question you know is going to get talked around. You're not going to pin anybody down on that, and it's almost never revealing. And if you're going to, and I don't like these sort of very personal questions, like Donald Trump, your campaign's a comic book campaign. What do you say about that? I mean, that's also not one that's really designed to bring out policy differences between candidates. I saw Mark Caputo, who was the Florida correspondent for Politico, who has covered Bush and Rubio intently for years. He was like, "I'll never forgive CNBC for cutting off their exchange." Like that was a good exchange.
Yeah,
and they stepped on.
It's not just CNBC. I think a lot of these, here's something that I've learned a couple lessons in my life as an interviewer. Sometimes when I'm having people on my podcast, I'll have a list of questions. But if someone starts riffing on something interesting, you don't stick to that list. You just follow, let them lead you. When I used to play in rock bands and back in Frederick, Maryland, there'd be a moment where we would finally get the audience with us and they'd be up dancing or they'd be up really into a song. And that was always when our lead singer would decide to give a soliloquy, like stop the music and talk for 10 minutes and totally kill the vibe, when you should just keep the music coming, right? It's like, I think George Costanza said, it's like robbing a bank. You don't hang around out front and wait for the police to come, you know? Like when you have something good going, don't kill the vibe. Don't kill the mood. Let it sort of play with it a little bit. And I don't know why CNBC, and it's not just them, all these debates, once they get a good exchange, they feel like they have to move on really quickly. No, let it play out. Let it marinate. They never do, but they should.
And I just think that, CNBC doesn't have a long history of doing debates. You know, I think what makes for good TV on CNBC, I mean, they're really not a political network. What they think is good TV doesn't necessarily translate to a debate setting. You know, like Fox News, say what you want about Fox News, like they know good TV. And so I thought they had questioning that made for good TV. But this is all sort of this is theater review. I thought CNBC did a bad job as far as theater is concerned. But to the extent that good theater can bring out interesting comments from the candidates, that's bad substantively. The attacks on the stage were sort of the tired old, grr, liberal media asking me mean questions, blah, blah, blah. And like that, I find that so tired. I can't believe that Republican voters still buy this crap.
I disagree with you. And we normally agree on things like this, but I disagree. I do think there's a difference in the framing of questions that essentially every question posed to Republicans are all these wedge wedge questions, always attempting to get them to fight with each other or to make them look bad or to take stances that are going to hurt them later. No, I'll tell you, the sad thing is, and I think you were right earlier, though, when you said that a CNBC debate should be a little more in the weeds and a little more substantive. There was a good question asked 15 or 20 minutes after the debate during the post-debate roundup while CNBC was still covering the debate briefly. They interviewed one of the guys interviewed Donald Trump, and they asked him, I think, a really good question, which was every once in a while, the Republican Party has a populist moment. And you have been critical of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. Are there any circumstances where you would support it? And Trump actually gave a really good, I think, at least an interesting answer where he said, I'm not against free trade at all. I just think we need to worry about currency manipulation. And that if we could hammer out, make that part of the deal, that was interesting. And that was the kind of thing you would expect on CNBC, but not the kind of thing that we ended up seeing on the debate stage last night.
Right. I mean, it wasn't devoid of it. I mean, they asked tax questions, for example. So it's not like they completely abdicated their responsibilities. But I think they're getting beat up to the degree they strayed from that. But but just to go to my other point, how many times can a Republican presidential candidate attack the debate moderator and impress anybody? I mean, you know, Newt Gingrich sort of owned that card in 2012, and that helped them win, you know, one primary in South Carolina. Now they all do it. And I mean, how is it going to be transparent that you're attacking the moderator to avoid? I mean, this is misdirection at its most pathetic.
No, but I didn't see it. I agree that it works. I did not see it as trite. To me, it felt organic and it felt legitimate. I do believe that the framing of the questions was inappropriate and betrayed a sort of, if not a liberal bias, then certainly a bias toward drama as opposed to substance.
I mean, one of the interesting moments to me was the fantasy football moment,
that was interesting, and people beat up on that. I thought it was a better question than it got credit for being.
Well, I mean, there is a scandal going on right now.
Yeah.
About fantasy football is a business. It is a business that people pay money for, and companies are making money by ripping off customers. And it's a legitimate question. What should the government role be in to regulate an industry that's being found to be ripping people off. Now, Jeb gets that question. He answers it in kind of a funny way. He talks about his own fantasy football record.
That was the best. I mean, that was Jeb at his best, which I think is problematic. That was the one question where he actually was joyful and interesting and funny and compelling.
But then after he did, I mean, he got a good laugh out of his line. He answered it in the libertarian way that government shouldn't come in there and start regulating everything. But then Chris Christie jumps in and, like, berates the entire question. Well, we should be talking about ISIS, not freaking fantasy football, and gets a huge response. And so, I mean, I felt bad for Jeb there. Like, he had the temerity to actually answer the question asked of him as opposed to blowing up the whole question.
It's happened to me. The last time I was on Bill Maher, it was three against one. It was three liberals against me. And I made a point that had Bill on his heels a little bit. And then Joanne Reed jumps in and just, well, that's a non sequitur. You know, just totally shifted direction. It's really hard when you've got all those variables and people like just undercutting everything you say, even if you have a good moment. Somebody else undercuts it. And I do think that what Christie did at that moment was very insincere and was an example of pandering, because he's Mr. Law and Order on every other issue. But on the issue of gambling, online gambling, for some reason he thinks the NFL should have an exemption or a carve out. It was very transparently pandering and I think out of character for the Law and Order Chris Christie to take that position. But of course, it totally undermine Jeb Bush at that moment.
You know, we both were asked to contribute to this Politico magazine piece post-debate, you know, which candidates are doomed now.
Did they print that? I feel like half the time I email them and I never see it. Okay.
It's up. It was up by midnight last night.
Good. Okay.
And And you're there saying, you know, Jeb Bush should call it a day. But I said Chris Christie, not because he had a bad night. I thought he had a pretty good night. But you go through all the candidates. I think everybody has a legitimate reason to stick around. You know, either you're polling, you're currently polling well, like Trump or Carson. You've got money in the bank to stick it out through the winter, like Bush or Cruz or Rubio. You got nothing else better to do, like Fiorina and Jindal and Graham and Huckabee and Pataki. You have a job, but no one at home is mad at you about it. You know, Kasich's numbers are good. Paul's numbers are good. The one guy who doesn't fit any of those criteria is Christie. He has a job to do. He's been destroyed in the polls at home. He's down to 35%. Now, Bobby Jindal's down to 35 too, but he's leaving in 2 months. Christie's got 2 years left. And, you know, he's term limited, but if he wants to have anything after this, if he wants to run for Senate or run for president somewhere down the line, he can't walk out the door, you know, below 40% with the state's credit rating in shambles, with the pension costs going through the roof, with his transportation fund nearing bankruptcy. He's got to go home and deal with this stuff, and he's getting killed because he's not. So I think he is the one candidate who's actively damaging himself by staying in. I hear what you're saying about Jeb hurting his legacy, but like Jeb's not doing anything else after this. You know, you'll go big or go home. Christie actually is hurting himself, and that's why I think he's got reason to get out.
I actually thought Christie had a great performance. I don't think it matters because we've decided that he, at least for the time being, we've decided he can't win. But I thought Christie, aside from that pandering example that I just mentioned, I think he did really well. And again, he should have ran in 2012, shouldn't he?
Well, I mean, people say that. He definitely, you know, having to run before Bridgegate would have been better than running after Bridgegate. But it's also very possible that 2012 was not a winnable election for Republicans, that the economy was growing at a fast enough clip relative to 4 years ago that Obama was not really beatable and better to go when he was leaving the stage. So it's hard to be precise what is the correct timing, because you can never test the counterfactual. I think he would have been better having not closed the bridge. And if that had never happened, he would be in a much better place right now.
Yeah, I think it would have been. I think we agree that it would have been better had he not shut down the George Washington lanes or whatever. All right, Bill, I'm freaking exhausted, but get the book, people.
Yes.
Do me the solid. It's called Too Dumb to Fail. Pre-order. And maybe you've already pre-ordered a copy. Get two copies. Get three copies. You can give them out. Tell your friends. We don't ask for much here.
What you should do is you should pre-order three copies. You should then send an email to Matt telling him you have done so. And Matt will handwrite you a special Christmas IOU gift card that you can then put in an envelope and give on Christmas. Say, you will get this book a month from now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they do book plates and stuff. I mean, we should have a special, something special for DMZ fans. I mean, I don't know what it is, but what can I do? Because you guys are awesome and loyal and smart as hell, too, judging by the comments, which I sometimes engage in. But I always read them, whether I comment or not. Bill Scherer, I do like your carry idea, and you had something big at RCP too this week. Let's plug that.
This got the right really mad. this is probably the maddest I've seen in the comment threads there. you sort of alluded to this earlier, that I argued the Republican Party should quit scandal politics. It just keeps backfiring on them. Benghazi's now backfired twice on them. Fast and Furious, Solyndra, IRS, these things all went nowhere. Even Whitewater, even impeachment was a big backfire. Just boosted Clinton's ratings. It hurt their 98 midterms. The counter to that always is, well, you don't want there to be oversight and they're breaking the law and they need to search for the truth. Go search for the truth. Have an investigative committee. Go ahead. Doesn't mean you have to grandstand about it. Doesn't mean you have to make it into a political talking point. Just do the investigation and come out with the facts and see what people say about it. But trying to make it into a political thing every time, you know, it never works. And it doesn't work for Democrats either. You know, Abu Ghraib didn't work. Iran-Contra didn't work. I mean, I'm glad the information is out there. The investigation should have occurred, but obviously it didn't. It didn't stop George H.W. Bush from being elected in 88 or George W. Bush being reelected in 2004. So it's
I think you're absolutely right. And as a conservative, as somebody who wants to beat Hillary Clinton, that's a safe assumption. I mean, you can't count on a silver bullet scandal taking anybody down. If it happens, it happens. It's icing on the cake. But if that's your hope, then, you know, if the hope is they're going to find out that Obama, whatever, was born in Kenya, or like, if that's what you're hanging your hope on, you're screwed. You need to win, because you're winning proactively the battle of ideas. You're out, you know, you have a better ground operation, whatever, whether it's infrastructure or ideas, you need to be to deserve victory, and you can't count on some huge scandal bailing you out. If it happens, it happens, but do not put your eggs in that basket.
Well, I think
you're
that,
right, Bill.
And
I don't know why people were mad at you over that.
Well, because I'm not saying that if you deeply believe there's a scandal there to go ferret it out. I'm saying, go ferret it out. Go have a ball. But if you are letting, if you're putting all of your political hopes on that, I think there's an actual, there's always an argument that, well, they're distracting Obama, or they're distracting Clinton. You know, they're driving down poll numbers, and they're taking him off their game. And maybe that's true to a certain extent, but you're getting distracted too. You're not spending your time on developing the policy ideas that actually do win elections. And because all your energies are being put into, you know, going down these rabbit holes. So to the extent that you, Matt, are saying, let's have Ryan and Rubio lead a solutions party. Well, let's start spending your time on those actual solutions and talking about them, and talking less about Benghazi, because that's not working.
Yeah. And again, Bill, that goes back to, you guessed it, too dumb to fail. And right now, this is the fundamental question. We are at a crossroads. Is conservatism going to be the party of ideas, the party of Marco Rubio and Paul Ryan, young, optimistic, energy, 21st century inclusive? That's what I call for in too dumb to fail. Or is it going to be too dumb? Is it going to go the other direction, the angry, populist, aggrieved, frustrated direction of Donald Trump? There's a lot of range between those two visions, and right now we are teetering. It could go either direction, and I think the implications down the road are huge in the long term, because the brand could set in where the Republican Party is known as the party of Rubio or the party of Trump. This election is huge. I'm not to say that Rubio or Trump are the only two. I mean, you could say Jeb versus Carson, maybe, or whatever. But I think that those are the two, the most quintessential examples of this binary sort of choice that we have in front of us. It's an exciting time to be covering this race.
Never dull, Matt Lewis. Always good to talk to you.
Always good talking to you, Bill Scherer. Follow us on Twitter at DMZ Show. Read Bill's stuff at Politico Magazine and RCP. And check me out at The Daily Caller, Daily Beast, Week.com, Telegraph, and Matt Lewis in the News podcast. And, of course, listen to this podcast. You can get it on iTunes and comment here on Blogging Heads TV.
Till next week.
See you, buddy. Have a good one.